gentlemen, welcome again to another edition of Liberty Unbridled. I am your host, Ken Molman. It appears we're having music problems again tonight. Thank you, Blog Talk. That's enough of that. Thank you. As mentioned, you are listening to Liberty Unbridled on the My View Matters Radio Network. This is Ken Molman. I am your host tonight. And we've got a few topics on board. If you'd like to call in tonight, the number here is area code 858-683-1326. Again, 858-683-1326. And getting right to it here, we have our guest on the phone. Katie is with the Kentucky Hemp Museum, and we're calling to get an update. Katie, you're on the air.
Hi, Ken. Thanks for having me on your show again.
Oh, no problem. Glad to have you back. So,
well, I guess I'll just...
Go ahead.
Well, I can just kind of jump into to an update since the last time. The last time we spoke, we were still kind of in limbo as far as the hemp bill in Kentucky. We were seeing some games played, I think, from a few people in Frankfurt. But with a lot of public support and a lot of phone calls to legislators and things like that, the public pressure managed to get that hemp bill passed. So we ended up passing a hemp bill. It was a little bit different than the original bill. It was a little bit of a compromise, but essentially the bill is pretty similar to what it was before. There's a few changes, one or two big things that we felt like we could deal with, and for the most part, pretty much the same, and we got that bill passed. So that's where we are now. We have passed the bill in Kentucky. Governor Steve Beshear allowed the bill to become law. He didn't sign it, but he did allow it to become law without his signature. And now we're sort of moving on into the future and our next project, which, of course, is trying to get a hemp bill passed in D.C.
Well, and I want to rewind a little bit in case folks weren't aware of all the, I want to say drama, but basically the drama behind getting this bill passed in Kentucky, because there was quite a bit of it. You know, we had the bill was out there. It went to the Senate. And then it got stuck in a committee with my representative, Tom McKee, and there were some shenanigans going on there, and it looked like for a moment that there was a very good chance that that bill was going to get killed, that they were not going to let that bill get out of committee, and that, or they were going to try to run the clock on it, I guess, is actually more what it looked like they were doing. And, you know, meanwhile, you had Thomas Massey and John Yarmuth come out in favor of the industrial hemp, but I believe they spoke, they gave testimony down in Frankfurt, correct?
They did. In fact, it was Representatives Thomas Massey and John Yarmuth and Senator Rand Paul who all came out and testified in support of this legislation. And they're not the only legislators on the federal level that are supporting it. And here in Kentucky, you know, we've got others that have come on board. If I'm not mistaken, did Brett Guthrie come on board as well for industrial hemp?
I can't confirm that. I honestly am not sure.
Well, they did turn out and they did support that legislation. And, you know, that was in the Senate hearing, and that bill passed the Senate Ag Committee unanimously. There was not one no vote in the Senate Ag Committee, which doesn't happen very often. And then, like you said, when it got to the House, we thought we were going to have a little bit of a hang-up there in Chairman McKee's committee. But, I think what happened there, he had a new bill that some folks in Frankfurt wanted to try to pass in place of what the Hemp Commission had worked on. And he was attempting to pass that bill instead of what we had originally all agreed on. So it was kind of a last-minute thing. You know, at the very, very last moment, all the representatives on that committee got the language of this new bill, and some of them got it that morning. And they were expected to vote on it, But there, it was a big kind of an argument in this hearing, and they ended up not voting one way or the other. Chairman McKee wanted to pass his new bill. The members of the committee did not want to pass the new bill. They wanted to vote on the original bill. And there was a little bit of an argument between some of the members on the procedures and Robert's rules and the fact that, you know, the original bill should still be able to be voted on. And the chairman of the committee, Tom McKee, just said, all right, that's it. We'll take a break from this from this hearing. We're going to take a recess, and we'll come back later. And ended up canceling the later meeting as well. So we were just sort of stuck at that point. But that week, I know probably hundreds of people started calling their legislators and saying, hey, we want to vote on this bill. We want to vote on this bill. I believe that Chairman McHugh was getting a lot of phone calls that week, and he decided in the following week to give us another hearing on that bill. The hearing, instead of taking, you know, full hour like the one before it, that hearing was probably over in 10, 15 minutes. They brought up the hemp bill. They talked about it a little bit. They voted on it. It passed with only one nay vote, and it moved on. And that was it, you know, and that's all we were asking, just a fair vote. And we got that fair vote, and it passed, no problem. And then when the bill got to the House, we thought, okay, should pass, no problem. We're pretty sure we have the votes. We can defeat any amendments. We have enough votes. Basically, just pass it out of the House, and let's get it to the governor. And I believe Speaker Stumbo worked on his own new version of what he wanted the hemp bill to be, and he brought that up as an amendment, and the amendment was brought up by floor leader Rocky Atkins, so it was called the Atkins Amendment, although he didn't actually write the amendment. And what happened after that was, you know, they said, all right, we're going to bring up this amendment. Everybody from the grassroots, I mean, people from the Hemp Commission, everybody said, hey, we don't like this amendment. It's not just amending the bill. It's rewriting the entire thing from start to finish. The very first line in the amendment says, you know, starting from page one, line one, or right at the beginning to all the way to the end, delete all that language and insert the following language in place of it. So it wasn't amending something to just simply make a change to it. It was deleting the entire language of the original bill that had already passed with only, you know, I think at that point there was only seven people total that had voted against it at this point, and just rewriting the entire thing. So put a lot of grassroots pressure on floor leader Atkins, a lot more pressure on people's legislators saying, hey, we want the original bill passed. We don't want any amendments. And at that point, you know, I believe that Speaker Stumbo and floor leader Atkins knew that they had to pass something, and they were going to have to make some compromises from what they wanted to pass in their amendment. So there was a kind of a long series of meetings between Senator Paul Hornback, who was the original sponsor of the bill, and several other legislators, including floor leader Atkins and others. In fact, legislators that are, you know, not even legislators anymore. My previous state senator, Joey Pendleton, was involved in working on this bill and working out some of the kinks. And so there was some compromising from both sides, but I do believe that the original bill, the heart and soul of what we want to see for the hemp movement, I believe that that's all there. You know, there's a few little administrative changes, a few, you know, things that are different. There's a few things in there that give more authority and more power to the Hemp Commission. But, you know, for the most part, the heart and soul of what we wanted to see in that legislation is still there. So the bill that the amendment that did finally pass with all the negotiations, and once everything was on the table and we said, all right, you know, that's it, we can agree on this. That bill passed no problem, passed right through the House, went right to the governor, and like I said before, he didn't sign it, but he did allow it to go into law.
Sure. And, yeah, I know during the process, I know when McKee was kind of stalling things in his committee, you know, I made some calls. I live in Pendleton County. I live in Tom McKee's district. So I made calls to family members and had, you know, I have family members that are left-leaning, right-leaning, whatever. You know, that was one of the interesting things in this is the Courier-Journal had a story about how hemp was the great political unifier. And they had run polling and showed that, I mean, I can't even remember now, 60-something percent of Kentuckians supported industrial hemp. And we were able to, at that level, at the grassroots level, kind of push things along. I was told that some other folks who had relatives not related to my wife's family in Pendleton County were able to make some calls and get folks fired up too. So I absolutely do believe that Tom McKee got a good number of phone calls down in Frankfort from across the political spectrum. And, you know, I think that that's what helped that. And then, you know, when it looked like the thing was dead, I mean, there was a time where it looked like it was going to die. Stumbo was digging his heels in, and the folks that wanted that other version were digging their heels in and saying, we're not going to do it unless we get this. And correct me if I'm wrong, but the other version wouldn't have done squat other than to commission a study to determine the economic benefit. Is that, am I mistaken there, or was that the crux of the alternate bill?
Yeah, that was one of the major elements of that bill. There were a few small other things, but, you know, that first version that they wanted to pass was essentially just going to have the commission sit on what we're doing now, do a study through UK, and, you know, that, I mean, that was the main thing. It wasn't going to set up a regulatory agency. It wasn't going to allow for any one agency, whether it's the Department of Agriculture or the Hemp Commission or UK or the state police or anybody, to do the regulations. But actually I'm wrong on that. It did. The first version did have the had the state police in charge of issuing permits. And
that's right.
So the state police were originally, yeah, that kind of slipped my mind there for a second. It had a commission of 5-year study, and that was going to be paid for out of the Industrial Hemp Program Fund, which was set up for the commission to cover its expenses and to do education, to, you know, set up this regulatory committee. And but this new version was going to have the state police in charge of the permitting process, and it was also
and it's important to note here. It's important to note right here that the state police were the main people speaking out against the industrial hemp bill at all during the hearings. I mean, they were the number
one
group there saying this is bad. We don't want to do this. You know, basically, in a very nice way, saying their officers were too incompetent to tell the difference between hemp and marijuana. And that giving them the authority to license it was really, in my opinion, a slap in the face. I mean, that was, I mean, it would be like, it was more kind of like when we have these issues about concealed carry for firearms. There are states that are shall issue states and states that are may issue states. And the may issue states generally fall back on law enforcement deciding who gets to carry and who doesn't. And in those scenarios, the only people who ever get to carry are police officers and their friends and family and politicians with the right pool. And that was my real concern with that particular version, was that there was nothing that set up a specific, you know, framework where the police would have had to say, okay, all right, sir, you've complied with all of our regulations, you get a license. There's nothing that would have set up these are the set of guidelines you have to meet to get a license. It would have been completely subjective based upon the state police, and I had a very big problem with allowing an agency that had declared its intent against the whole movement being in charge of setting the rules and getting to decide who got a permit and who didn't.
Right, and the state police the whole time were arguing. One of their main arguments was that it was going to cost them so much money. They weren't going to be able to keep an eye on it. They weren't going to be able to afford to, you know, enforce anything because it was going to just, you know, suck up their budget to do background checks and do field testing and things like that. And our argument was, all right, we don't want you to do it. You know, we'll let the Agriculture Department, which is the largest regulatory agency in the state, let them handle it. The Agriculture Department already runs background checks. They can run a background check. I mean, they can said they could do like 5-10 background checks in just maybe 10-15 minutes. And it wasn't going to cost them $700 just for one test. It was going to cost them, you know, considerably less than that. So, you know, we weren't asking the state police to do that. And that was the one thing they didn't want to do. So why turn around and just hand it over to them and say, okay, now do it. You said you didn't want to do it, but we want you to do it anyway.
Right.
It just didn't make any sense. It really didn't. And there was some other things in there, like, you know, it was going to force Commissioner Comer to step down from the Hemp Commission. It was going to take the Hemp Commission away from the Agriculture Department. And in place of Commissioner Comer as the chair of the commission, it was going to put two co-chairs in there, one of them being Commissioner Rodney Brewer, the commissioner of the state police, and the other one being the dean of agriculture, who right now is Scott Smith, who I believe is leaving the UK. So, you know, who knows who's going to be the next dean, who knows who's going to be in that position. But the thing is, Commissioner Brewer was testifying against the bill. He was in there,
right,
you know, saying he didn't want it. He went on a debate saying he didn't want industrial hemp. It was going to be bad for Kentucky. Now, why would they put him in as a chair of a commission whose goal is to progress the hemp movement in Kentucky, you know, to set everything up? It's a commission that is supposed to be dedicated to seeing hemp in a responsible manner grown across the state, see our farmers getting back to the land, see family farms starting to grow again, and maybe have a cash crop that can replace tobacco, because all over the state and all over the country, politicians are trying to get rid of tobacco. Well, here in Kentucky, a lot of people's fortunes were made on tobacco. Now they're telling us to get rid of it. Everything they want to do is to get people to quit smoking. Tobacco is bad. You know, well, there's one thing we use tobacco for, and that's nicotine. It's a drug. So if you're saying, well, we can't grow tobacco, but they're not giving the farmers anything to replace tobacco, and they can grow soybeans and corn and all these other things, whatever they want to grow, but why not give them the option to grow industrial hemp if they want to, if there's a market for it? And don't let it be up to the politicians to decide where the markets, what the markets are thinking or where the winds are blowing as far as the economy goes. If the market is there for the hemp, the farmers will find out about it and they will grow it to fill that niche. If there is no market for hemp, they won't grow it.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't tobacco the replacement crop for hemp? When they made hemp illegal to grow, a lot of farms switched over to tobacco.
It probably was, you know, and it was all around the same time of alcohol prohibition. You know, when Henry Ford invented the hemp car, he invented this hemp car. It was going to be run on hemp oil. It was made out of hemp plastic. When Rudolf Diesel invented the diesel engine, he made that engine to be able to use vegetable oil, whether it came from hemp or whether it came from switchgrass or whatever they wanted to grow at the time. They knew hemp was the way to go back then. But he made this diesel engine run on vegetable fuel. And that was so that the farmers could make their own fuel and power their own tractors and run their own equipment on their farm. Well, you know, first they got rid of alcohol. They prohibited alcohol, so the farmers couldn't run their cars on alcohol fuel. Then they prohibited hemp, so the farmers couldn't run their engines on diesel fuel. And it wouldn't surprise me if tobacco was there to replace hemp, but You know, if you ask me, hemp is so much more valuable than tobacco. You know, I have no problem with tobacco, but there's essentially one product you can make out of tobacco, and that is a drug ingested.
Cigarettes.
With hemp, there's no drug, and you can make a million different things out of it. You know, anything you can think of, you can make out of hemp. So.
Right. And that gets back to the whole discussion, and you touched on this before, about the opposition was saying there was no market for hemp, and that, you know, this is a there was actually one of the talking points I saw that came out of this was, well, if we tell farmers they can grow hemp, we're going to end up bankrupting farmers, because obviously the farmers aren't smart enough to figure out what works or what doesn't. And so the state, they were taking the position that by passing hemp, we were endangering farmers and family farms. And, you know, my response to that was, you don't think family farms are already in danger? You don't think family farms are already under attack? I mean, my father-in-law was a tobacco farmer until the lease system got to the point where, for those that haven't grown tobacco, that's a very difficult thing. I've never seen a more complex process in agriculture in my life. And it's not an easy thing to do. But these farmers are already pushed out of tobacco. And my father-in-law is one of the very many farmers that, and when they got out of tobacco, what did they grow? They grew hay or, you know, straw. Well, whoopity-doo-dah. You know, that there's only so much of that you need. I mean, yeah, it's needed, but it's not exactly a high-dollar item. And to provide a item, some other good that could work for some farmers. I'm not saying, and we talked about this the last time you were on, this is not the silver bullet that is the cure-all for all of Kentucky's woes, but to give options to farmers, to let them have another crop that has proven viable in the past, that has worked in the past, that has many, many applications, is not a bad thing. Let the free market decide. Yeah. You know what? If there's no market, then people won't grow it because there's no market. I mean, that's how the free market works. So I think what we've done, and I thank you and all the members that were heavily, heavily involved in this for investing the time, because, assuming we get this at the federal level, and that's an important thing to remind everybody of, this doesn't nullify the federal law. All it does is it says if the feds make it legal to grow hemp, then we have a regulatory structure in place, ready to go. We can start issuing licenses the day after. And, that's not a bad thing. It gives us options. I mean, and anybody who's connected to the farming community knows what farmers need now is options. And the stuff coming out of UK, they're telling people to grow green peppers and grapes instead of tobacco. Well, I mean, how many green peppers do we really need? I like green peppers, don't get me wrong. But how many do we really need? I mean, do we need every acre in Kentucky covered with green peppers? There's certainly not a market for that. You know, and in that market, you're competing against the Mexican farmers, and that's going to be a highly competitive thing as well. So I just think that this is a very good thing that's happened. You know, we got it through. I think Beshear showed a lack of leadership by not signing the bill, by not signing on more strongly to the bill. I'm disappointed in Governor Beshear for not signing on to it and promoting it as what it is, which is an opportunity. And I applaud our federal delegation that came and spoke in favor of this and that have sponsored the bill. Now, where is that at now? I mean, who's got a bill sponsored? Who are the co-sponsors? How many co-sponsors? Do you have any of that information?
I don't know the official total for the co-sponsors, but our both of our senators are signed on as co-sponsors for Senator Ron Wyden's bill. Ron Wyden, I believe, is from Oregon. So Senator Rand Paul and Senator Mitch McConnell have both come on board with that bill, and so we do feel like having Senator McConnell on board, will really give us an opportunity to maybe get a fair vote on it, maybe get a vote at all. And in the House, our Congressman Thomas Massey sponsored legislation for industrial hemp farming in D.C. and, well, I'm sorry, for the entire United States. And
sure.
He's got well over 30 co-sponsors at this point. So, I mean, co-sponsors
excellent.
Are just coming on one after another for the House bill. So, but, you know, that really goes to show that this movement and this issue is very, very long way. Actually, I'm just going to relate a little conversation I had with the president of Vote Hemp, Eric Steenstrom. And I also want to give them another little shout out in the hearing in a minute for people who want to contact their legislators. But talking to the president of Vote Hemp, and he was telling me, you know, back 15 years ago, the only person who would even consider coming anywhere close to the hemp issue was Congressman Ron Paul. And so he came on, he was the original sponsor of hemp legislation for many years, and absolutely nobody wanted to come anywhere near that bill. They didn't want to hear about it, they didn't want to talk about it, and they sure as heck weren't going to co-sponsor it with him. And now, 15 years later, Senator Mitch McConnell is a co-sponsor of hemp legislation. Like, this is a huge, huge step. And, I mean, it's a huge leap from where we were 15 years ago to where we are now as far as hemp legislation goes. And I do feel like we're at a tipping point. States are changing their laws one after another. Just Google search for states and, you know, different states in their hemp legislation. There's dozens of states that are coming up with hemp legislation. And, you know, Kentucky, I do believe, has the ability to be at the top of the pack, especially with regard to certified seed. But we're not going to be alone in this. So, but I think it's a great thing. And so we are in D.C. as far as where we are in the issue, and as far as activists go, we need to turn our attention to D.C. And so for that reason, I want to just put out the website for Vote Hemp. It's votehemp.org. And they are a great source of information for all the most recent hemp news and things like that. But they also have forms to fill out if you want to send a message to your legislator, and maybe you're not sure who your legislator is, or maybe you're not, you know, from Kentucky and we can't list your legislators on here or something like that. But if you want to send a message to your legislator, Vote Hemp actually has forms on there that you can fill out. And that will help you very easily and quickly send a message to your legislators. So they've got a great resource for anybody who wants to get involved to check out votehemp.org.
Well, I certainly appreciate that. I mean, we need at this point any of the Kentucky senators or not senators, but state house reps that haven't signed on to this bill, we need to apply pressure to that immediately. And we need to get anybody who has signed on to know that we appreciate what they're doing, and certainly appreciate that the votehemp.org group has set up that website so that there is a central place where people can go and write to their legislator and say, I support industrial hemp. I want you to support industrial hemp. My understanding is that not all of the Kentucky House delegation to the U.S. House has signed on to this. And as far as I know, the only ones beating the drum for this at all are Thomas Massey and John Yarmuth. And so if you live in the 1st District, the 2nd District, Whitfield, Guthrie, the 5th District, Hal Rogers, now Hal's probably not going to budge, but at least you can put some pressure on him. And Andy Barr in the 6th, we can apply that grassroots pressure to tell these folks, we want this, you know.
Right, and we already know that grassroots pressure changes the direction of where it's going. I mean, if we put on enough pressure, we can change anybody's mind. And we saw that happen here in Kentucky.
Absolutely, because at the end of the day, if anybody doesn't know the political game, at the end of the day, a politician's number one priority in general is to get reelected. So popular support and popular outcry can absolutely affect the outcome of legislation. And so we need to be very loud and very vigilant and continue to beat this drum. We've succeeded in Kentucky. Now the next step is at the federal level.
Absolutely.
So,
and I believe Kentucky's going to lead that charge. I mean, we've already seen it from our federal delegation. They know they want this. They know they support this bill, and they know that they have people here in the state that they can come home to that will back them up on the issues. So I agree with you, Ken. We need lots of phone calls going to our federal delegation. If they are not on board with the hemp bill yet, give them a call. Tell them you support it. You want them to support it. If they're already on board, give them a call and tell them thank you. I promise politicians don't hear thank you nearly enough.
Oh, I guarantee
if
that.
If they do things right more often, they'd probably hear a lot more thank you.
Well, you know, it's one of those things. The only time you ever get a phone call is when somebody's angry. So, but definitely it can affect the outcome of this. And I certainly thank Thomas Massey and John Yarmuth for supporting this legislation. I think it's something that's good for the entire state of Kentucky. I think that it is something that provides options to our family farms and may stem the tide of the decline of the family farm. I mean, we've seen that over the years, and anything that we can do to allow family farms to continue to function is a good thing for the state.
Mm-hmm.
So,
absolutely.
Well, Katie, I want to thank you. Do you have anything else you need to promote? I know you wanted to do the top half of the hour, and we're past the bottom of the hour, so I don't know if you want to stay on or if there's anything else you want to promote or what you have.
No, I think that's it. I wanted to make sure I got the plug in there for Vote Hemp, because they do have a great method on there for people to email their legislators really quickly. So, check out votehemp.org. Also, our website, as always, KentuckyHempCoalition.com. And keep an eye out for some more really big things going on in the near future with the Kentucky Hemp Growers Cooperative Association. In fact, when that stuff comes out public and when we start, start promoting the cooperative, I'd like to come back on the show and give you an update on all that.
Absolutely. Anytime, Katie. It's certainly appreciated. All the work you and other activists have put into this is greatly appreciated. And I want to thank you for coming on and giving our listeners the update on what's going on with this. So thank you very, very much. Again, folks, that's votehemp.org.
It's my pleasure, Ken.
Yeah, again, folks, votehemp.org. That's what you want to go to. It'll let you contact your legislators to support the bill. Again, Katie, thank you very, very much. I'm going to put you back on hold here. And, folks, we're going to take a quick break here, and we'll be back in a few minutes. You are listening to Liberty Unbridled on the My View Matters radio network.
Oh.
Being a victim of crime is no joke, but you do have options that can help you avoid becoming a victim. I'm Ed Springsteen of the My View Matters radio show, and on behalf of myself and co-host Ed Martin, I urge each of you to help us fight against crime. You can do your part by calling Crime Stoppers at 582-CLUE. Since 1982, Crime Stoppers has helped get over 23,000 criminals off the street with your help. Working together, we can make a difference to take our streets back. Please call Crime Stoppers at 582-CLUE, or you can visit them online at www.582clue.com. Remember, Crime Stoppers always offers up to a $1,000 reward. Get involved and help make a positive change in your neighborhood. Thanks.
Advertisers, here's a great way to reach a quality audience. Get heard on My View Matters and make some noise in the marketplace.
Email myviewmatters@aol.com for advertising opportunities. Make a sound investment.
All right, folks, and we're back. You are listening to Liberty on Bridle on the My View Matters radio network. If you'd like to call in about hemp, and then here in the second half, we're going to talk about CISPA and talk about the Boston Marathon bombing, you can call in at area code 858-683-1326. Again, 858-683-1326. And when you dial in, you've got to press 1, so I know you want to talk. So we do have people just listening in the queue. So if you want to talk, you got to press the 1 key. Otherwise, I don't know you want to talk. And that's, you know, I won't put you on if I don't know you want to talk. So anyway, I want to hit CISPA first because this is one that's pretty quick and pretty easy. CISPA is one of the bills that was proposed after the SOPA PIPA fiasco that happened last year. SOPA and PIPA were companion bills. One was in the Senate, one was in the House. And the idea behind these bills was that the government wants to monitor the internet for terrorism, for cyber attacks. That's the premise behind the bill. The problem is, just like with the Patriot Act and other bills like it, it goes way, way, way beyond anything having to do with true security and has major, major ramifications for our rights that are guaranteed to us in the Bill of Rights. CISPA particularly allows the government to monitor all transmissions. And we've talked about the different pieces and parts of the government that want into our electronic communications, from the FBI to the IRS. They're trying to get into and be able to see real time your email, your social media feed. They want to be able to spy, and that's what it is, spy on any person using those services, whether they're an American citizen or not, whether they've done anything wrong or not. They want to do that without a warrant. And what CISPA does is essentially it grants immunity to the internet providers, the backbone providers, the core service providers, from basically exposing what would normally be private communication, private information, to the federal government. That at its core is what this does. It basically allows the ISPs, the internet service providers, to be rats for the federal government without any ramifications whatsoever. So those privacy agreements you sign with your ISP, the privacy that you would assume would come with any service where it's private communication between you and someone else or you and a small group or whatever of people, that privacy expectation is being legislatively removed. It allows the government to come in and do whatever they want for whatever reason without a judge being involved to issue a warrant. Now, certainly, there's a case that if there is proof of illegal activity going on, that law enforcement would have the ability, the means, to monitor, to see if there is illegal activity going on. That process already exists today. You go to a judge, unless you work for federal law enforcement, federal law enforcement goes to a judge, the judge issues a warrant, and then at that point the warrant is properly served, and the monitoring occurs. And this stuff goes back years. It's wiretapping laws. It's all these laws that have been around for a very long time that have set the rules on what is allowed and disallowed. And these are things that the courts have ruled that oftentimes have ruled in the private entity's favor for privacy. And what they're trying to do is undo all of those privacy protections because, well, this is electronic. It's not the same as an in-person interaction in a private home. Now all of a sudden, because it's a slightly different modern version of what used to be, they're trying to retry all this stuff, and they're trying to get what they did not have, which is the ability to spy on you and me. And I have a very big problem with this because there is nothing today that stops law enforcement from getting a warrant, properly serving it, and getting this information. It's not a matter of the law that law enforcement can't get the information. If there is probable cause, if a judge agrees, yes, this doesn't look good, or yes, you have someone clearly engaging in what seems to be shady activity, so I will grant you that warrant. This is taking that process out. We're taking out a check and balance out of the system and letting law enforcement take control of the entire scenario. They get to decide whether or not to monitor you and to monitor me with no check and balance. And that's a big, big problem. For people who are not tech savvy, understand that communicating on the internet is no different than picking up the phone and calling someone. It's just a new way of doing what we've always done. People communicate. And we should be secure in those communications so long as there is no probable cause for government to interfere with that or to monitor that communication. And some will say, hey, well, you know, if you're not doing anything wrong, you don't have anything to worry about. Well, yeah, I'm sure that that's what the British told the colonists when they were, you know, going through and doing door-to-door searches and all of that back prior to the Revolutionary War. Hey, if you're not doing anything against the crown, you got nothing to worry about. Don't worry about it. No big deal. We're going to come in, make sure you got nothing going on. Okay, well, no problem. But our Bill of Rights was written specifically to address and to protect against what the crown was doing to the colonists, where they would just come in and demand to search your stuff. That's what the Fourth Amendment's all about. They'd knock on your door and demand to search your house. With no cause, no check and balance, the soldiers had autonomy to do it. That's what our Bill of Rights is there to protect. And we have to speak very loudly. Again, you know, we just talked to Katie at the Hemp Museum about this. You can make a difference in this. Now, unfortunately, CISPA has already passed the U.S. House at this point. We have 6 representatives from Kentucky in the U.S. House. We have 6 delegates. 2 voted against CISPA. And surprise, surprise, just like with the industrial hemp issue, the 2 people that were in favor of you and I keeping our rights in this regard were Thomas Massie and John Yarmouth. The other 4 representatives, Ed Whitfield, Brett Guthrie, Hal Rogers, and Andy Barr, all voted against your right to privacy on the internet. They voted to allow the government to monitor your communications, your private communications. And we need, now it's too late to do anything about it, but you need to make that call to them and say, I don't appreciate that you consider me a suspect, that I am now guilty until proven innocent. Because that's what this law is. It is guilty until proven innocent. You no longer, as my studio audience has just said, you no longer have the right to remain silent. You don't even know you're being investigated. It's a very bad precedent. Call Whitfield, Guthrie, Barr, and Rogers. Call these guys and tell them you do not appreciate that you are now considered a suspect until you're proven not to be through their actions in supporting CISPA. It's just not right. It is anti-American. And I've only got a few minutes left here, 10, 15 minutes left, so I want to move topics, but it's just so frustrating to me. And what's really stupid about this more than anything is that the Republicans were the ones that were really beating the drum for this. And all these Republicans go, oh, I don't know why we lose presidential races. I don't know why we lose races. Well, I can tell you why. Because everybody 35 years old and younger uses the internet, and they get this. They understand. They don't want the government monitoring what they do on the internet. And what they may be doing is completely legal, but it doesn't matter. They don't want the government spying on them. I can't believe the stupidity of the Republican Party to get behind something like this, that as much as they need to gather that youth vote and grab it in order to survive, they do something as stupid as this to cut their own knees out underneath of them. I don't get it. But we're going to move on because I need to get to the Boston stuff, and we only have 11 minutes left. So everybody saw the Boston Marathon bombing. And I was a little bit late to the game. I got in about 2 hours after it occurred because I was heads down at work. I had no idea what was going on. And about 5 o'clock jumped onto the internet when I was wrapping up work for the day. Said, what's going on Facebook? You know, and wow, what's all this stuff about a bombing? What? Huh? What? And, you know, quickly got up to speed, obviously. And make no mistake, whoever did this, you know, whether it's the suspects they have in custody, somebody else, whatever, inexcusable, absolutely inexcusable to attack innocent civilians, no matter what. I mean, even the rules of war say you don't go after civilians because everybody kind of gets it. It's kind of like how, you know, child rapists get killed in prison by other really bad people because even they get you don't go after kids. Same concept. You don't go after innocent people. You know, you got to beef with the government, go after the government. I mean, that's the rules of war. So there's been a lot of information flying around and a lot of theories and a lot of all kinds of different stuff on this. And I'm going to take things at their face value. You know, I'm not going to delve into the conspiracy theories. I agree with you. There's something that doesn't smell right. The folks that are on the conspiracy theory side, there's something here that doesn't quite sit right with me, but until you can prove otherwise, it just makes you sound crazy. So all I can tell you is, yes, I agree, something here doesn't seem right. It could just be a lack of information, but let's take it at face value. So the two guys that are supposed to have done this, alleged to have done this, two brothers. One is now dead. The police killed him. And the other was captured. And that's a good thing. I'm always in favor of the police. We've talked about this on the show before. The police's job is to apprehend suspects. It's up to the courts and juries to decide guilt or innocence. So anytime we bring in anyone to face a jury, that's a very good thing, right? We want that due process. We do not want the police to be judge, jury, and executioner. What concerns me, though, there's two pieces of this. First, the house-to-house searches that happened. Now, originally, not knowing all the information, you know, the declaration of martial law, you know, I can see that. You know, if there's an emergency situation, I've lived through one. There was a flood in the town I lived in. I thankfully wasn't in the flood, but nearby, there were people that were, you know, had everything destroyed. And the National Guard came in. martial law was declared, and the reason for that is they wanted to prevent looting and get the situation under control. I'm not necessarily against temporary martial law in a situation of pure chaos, which is what your natural disasters are. I mean, they're just chaos. I've lived through one. It's chaos. But when I learned more about what was going on or what had transpired with this, where the police were doing house-to-house searches and forcing people out of their homes and forcing people to allow the police to search a home, now I got a little bit of a problem. I mean, they're going and knocking on doors and forcing people out of their homes at gunpoint. And I've seen some of the video now. There's video of some of this happening now available on the web. And if you haven't seen it, you know, look around. You'll find it. Of people, you know, they're just like, hey, what was what's going on? The police are yelling, keep your hands on your head. And, you know, these people don't know what's going on. They're just like, hey, you know what? What's going on here? I have serious concerns about that because, again, the Fourth Amendment guarantees a right for you to be secure in your possessions. And that was all about during the Revolutionary War, prior to the Revolutionary War, where British soldiers would go door to door and search people's homes. That's what it was all about. And so I do have very serious concerns about that aspect of that. I mean, that's the martial law, okay, I get it. It's a disaster situation, temporary, okay. When you start knocking on people's doors, forcing them to come out at gunpoint, threatening people that are, I mean, they're just confused. They don't understand and yelling at them and, you know, tell them go over there and all this and searching homes. And I mean, no, I do have a concern about that. I think it's very good what happened, the actual situation where that homeowner discovered that the suspect was hiding in his boat in the driveway, called 911, said, hey, man, there's somebody hiding in my boat in the driveway. I think it's your dude. I don't think he put it quite that way because he's from Boston, so it'd be like, there's a guy in the car out in the driveway. Anyway, the point is, because they all speak with a speech impediment, I swear, Boston's just full of a speech impediment. Anyway, the point is, you know, there's been a big story about this guy because his boat got shot up and just beat to death, and it was his baby. And there's an outpouring of support, and this is a beautiful part of the story, outpouring of support from around the country of people sending this guy private donations for him to buy a new boat. Because, you know, it was his thing. He did the right thing, and the police shot up his boat. And, you know, I'd be kind of upset. I mean, he's upset about it. I don't blame him. I'd be upset, too. I did the right thing, and here I am. Now I got a boat full of holes. Well, what's a boat full of holes going to do? Sink. That's not going to help much. So I do appreciate that there is a silver lining to this cloud, that people around the country are voluntarily giving money to this guy for his loss, for doing the right thing. And I think that's a good part of this. Now back to the bad side of it, though. There's this big controversy. Now, this guy, the suspect, had become a U.S. citizen about a year prior to all this going down. And my understanding is there is no intention of giving this guy due process, that they're not going to Mirandize him, that they're going to send him to a military tribunal, not to a civilian court. And I have a very, very big problem with this. Because you know what? He may have had intent going back further than when he was a U.S. citizen. But that's not the point. He's a U.S. citizen. And the courts have ruled already that even non-citizens on U.S. soil have constitutional rights. They have basic human rights. And that one of those rights is due process. But this guy was a U.S. citizen. And whether he became a citizen with malice in his heart and intended on doing this back then or not is irrelevant. What's important is this guy was a U.S. citizen, and they're going to deprive him of due process because of the circumstances. This ends two ways. It's going to, if he's found guilty, it's going to end in the Supreme Court, and there are two possible outcomes. And we had a very interesting discussion about this Friday night. Another internet talk show host, Doc Thompson, who used to be on the local Big Talker here, 700 WLW, I was hanging out with him Friday night, and we all agreed. I mean, everybody at the table agreed. This is going to turn out bad, no matter what, because there's only two possible outcomes. If this guy is found guilty, it's going to get appealed all the way to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court hears it. It's either going to end in this guy gets acquitted because his rights were violated because he wasn't read his Miranda rights. I mean, how stupid is it? Just read him his freaking rights. Who cares? Read him his rights. But it's going to end with the whole thing getting overturned because they didn't read him his rights. Or the court's going to determine, well, under certain circumstances, U.S. citizens are allowed to be deprived of their rights. How is that good for you or me? I ask this question quite seriously. How is this good for you or for me that the government, based on certain circumstances, and of course the court won't be able to define specifics in this because they can never define a very specific circumstance. It makes no sense. They have to rule in a more broader sense. How is it ever a good thing that you or I, as United States citizens, can have our rights deprived of us under the circumstances? Something so critical as due process. Due process is the ultimate check and balance against the whole system. It's that you have to be arrested. You have to be arrested, charged, go to trial, face a jury of your peers, and all these people have to agree that you're guilty. That's the check and balance against tyranny. It's the check and balance against the cops just saying, you're guilty, man, you're in jail. Good luck. See you later. It's a check and balance against the military saying, hey, you're with us now. Have fun at Gitmo. I hear it's nice this time of year. There's no reason not to put this in a civilian court. The guy is a U.S. citizen. Do you have so little faith in the system that a jury of his peers, a jury of U.S. citizens from Boston, if he's truly guilty, wouldn't send his ass to the chair? I mean, really? You really don't believe that the system is strong enough to deal with this? Then what you're admitting is the system is broken and can never work. Wow, that's loud. Folks, we're out of time. I don't know why it's so loud, but the music's been messed up all day. This has been another edition of Liberty on Broadcom on the My View Matters Radio Network. Tune in next week for another episode, 7 p.m. Eastern Time. Thanks for listening.